calling the State Affairs Committee to order at 3:13 p.m. Thursday, January 25th, in the Max Gruenberg Room of the Osca Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Kopp, alternate. Representative Ledoux?
Here.
Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Tuck? Representative Josephson, alternate. And Chair
Price, here. And with six members present, we have a quorum to conduct business, and Representative Tuck has noted that he will be in and out today. We have one item on today's agenda. Continuation of House Bill 152 is heard Tuesday of this week. The amendment deadline was 10 a.m. this morning. It has come and gone, and there are no amendments on this piece of legislation. We've noticed public testimony today, and I'm going to go into that and then open it up for committee discussion, comments, etc. So at this time, I'm going to open public testimony, and I don't see any public testimony online. Is there any testimony in the room on House Bill 152? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony at this time on House Bill 152, which takes the bill back before the committee. At this point, especially given that we have Deputy Commissioner Dole and Mr. Duffy in the audience, as well as Christopher Weaver, Staff Judge Advocate for DMVA online, I'm going to provide the opportunity for any other committee questions. And Representative Birch, you're first in the queue.
We're having a discussion earlier about organized militia and kind of the term organized militia, Mr. Chairman, you know, kind of where it comes from, you know, how it's used in this context, and how it relates to, you know, the guard and you know, if one's a subset of the other. I thought maybe since we have some expertise here present, maybe we could get a clarification.
Absolutely.
Through the Chair, Representative Birch, by statute, the Alaska Organized Militia is defined as the members who have volunteered to serve in organizations. That would be the Alaska Air National Guard and its members, the Alaska Army National Guard and its members, the Alaska Naval Militia and its members, and the Alaska State Defense Force. By comparison, Alaska also has an unorganized militia, which is the comparison there, and that's all able-bodied individuals able to serve over 18 years of age up to a certain age on the other end. It's part of that 1955 original statute that legally, according to our existing statutes, could be conscripted or required to serve in time of a dire emergency. And we also owe some answers to Representative Ledoux from last time we're prepared to proceed with, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It was more of a, in the context of how it fits into this, we're you know, trying to get a little better handle on exactly what that meant.
And Deputy Commissioner Dole, just a reminder, if you could identify yourself for the record before addressing, and I think based on your last comment, maybe now would be as good a time as any to address the questions Representative Ledoux had last time that you now have answers for.
For the record, for last question and this question, Deputy Commissioner Dole, State of Alaska, Department of Military Veterans Affairs, my apology, Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, in answering your question, we would first posit that in looking at who can call out the guard, the typical incident is not going to be the mega earthquake. It's going to be the child that's lost in one of the areas adjacent to one of our cities, perhaps, and the object is to get a vehicle out before sun goes down to help find that child. In that case, time is of the essence. Even the time to find out, oh, the governor is unavailable, he's in a meeting or elsewhere, to go to the lieutenant governor to get back, that time is of the essence. You specifically, though, asked the question, can the governor issue a standing delegation to the lieutenant governor whenever he is incapacitated in order to call out the National Guard? Our answer is, and this was after 2 days of a fairly interesting constitutional question, the governor can delegate functions to the lieutenant governor under Article 3, Section 7 of the Constitution. A permanent delegation of authority may raise concerns with Article 3, Section 19, as that section gives the governor the specific military authority as commander-in-chief of the state's armed forces. Furthermore, The outer limits of the governor's delegation authority is a complex question that would require substantial time to address. It is also worth pointing out that Article 3, Section 9 of the Constitution provides that if the governor is temporarily absent from office, the lieutenant governor serves as the acting governor. So in that event, the lieutenant governor would be able to call out the guard in his or her acting capacity. Now, the department notes that there is no statute that specifically addresses that scope of a standing delegation or authority. If we look to our national model as an example of the federal military, the chain of command flows in terms of who can direct military action. If the president is unavailable, it is not the vice president. It is the combatant commander that can direct at least until the vice president swears or oaths in. So if the president is in a place that gets hit with a nuclear bomb and he's unfortunately unavailable, the combatant commanders would direct the military response until the vice president took the oath of office.
The combatant commander. What's the combatant commander?
The four-star general in charge of the particular part of the military responding.
So would he have the nuclear?
Representative
Ledoux? Would he have the nuclear code?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the state doesn't have nuclear weapons, so this is a stretch for me. It is my understanding there would be a means to address that, though, yes.
All right, thank you.
Representative Wall, a quizzical look on
your
face.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, seeing as we're not paralleling federal law, I wasn't aware that if the president was killed in a bomb, let's say, that the vice president would then have to be sworn in before the vice president, or what I would think would be the second in command, would be able to authorize military force, and that would be up to a four- or five-star general who would then... That's surprising to me. Also, within state, it sounded like what you read to us before says that the lieutenant governor is in... if the governor is incapacitated, automatically, without a swearing in, so that the lieutenant governor would be in charge without any kind of ceremony. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, it is an undefined and difficult question under state constitutional law. Lieutenant Weaver is on the line to address how other states address this issue. It is a difficult question that we cannot provide you a clear answer on with 2 days of research, according to the Department of Law.
Representative Woolwood, Lieutenant Colonel Weaver's perspective be helpful?
And just in 1 second, if I may follow up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess this goes to the question of, are elected leaders in charge, or is the military in charge in these kinds of situations? And I guess that's something that on federal or local level should probably be determined before a emergency or catastrophe happens. And I know if we consult the military, they might have a different answer than if we can consult the civilian side of things. So I don't know. Looks like you want to say something.
It's through the chair, Representative Wool, the civilian authority always remains in charge and responsible. They may not be the one to say, go send the Humvee to save that child. However, they're responsible for how that civilian authority is responsible for how that action is carried out. Is it timely? Did it succeed? Did it do other things? Now, the civilian authority also has, with the nature of military officers being all virtually at-will employees, the ability to quickly make corrections if there's a loss in trust and confidence of the military officer who directed that life-saving activity or failed to direct that life-saving activity. I think it's important, too, Representative, when we look at the Alaska use as limited by the statute, it is only for life-saving situations. It is not for actions against Alaskans, only to save Alaskans.
Sure. Thank you for clarifying that.
Follow-up?
Yeah. Well, you had asked a question yesterday, Mr. Chair, about how many states specifically, and I would imagine that Mr. Dole probably has that answer. And my follow-up to your question would be what the time frame. You use 72 because that's what the federal law allows a base commander in a similar tradition. So I didn't know if other states that allow the adjutant general these kind of powers, if they are also mirroring the 72-hour time period, or they have a different one, and that was kind of attached to your question.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, and Mr. Chair, at this point, I would like to rely on my lifeline, Colonel Weaver, who has looked more at this particular parts of the questions you all raised.
Colonel,
ask that he testify.
Colonel Weaver, if you can hear us, can you put yourself on the record and speak to these questions raised both 2 days ago as well as restated by Representative Wohl just now?
So this is Lieutenant Colonel Chris Weaver. W-E-A, B as in Victor, E-R. I'm the S-J for the Alaska National Guard. I'll give a little feedback. I apologize. So we did extensive research based on the time we had. And we've come to, I can't tell you exactly how many states have it codified quite like this. Each state kind of does it differently, and I talked to a few of the other state SJAs as well, staff advocates as well. And some of them rely on the federal authority, which is Department of Directive 3025.18, and that's so you'll see it in the Department of Defense directives. Some of it just give general authority for the governor to delegate it to TAG. The difference when we were discussing it was the way our statute is currently stated is it's read as a restriction on the TAG to actually use immediate response authority. So I can't give you numbers. I could give you anecdotal information based on discussions with other SJAs. And a quick review of some of the statutes I've looked at.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, I believe you're next in the queue.
So, I spent a lot of time and had a lot of staff time put into researching this bill. And I feel like the bill has constitutional issues. I had 44 states have succession that runs five plus deep. So there's four states that don't have succession like that. Alaska is one of them, but where the governor actually appoints a line of succession. And we just saw that come through when we had the governor appointing Valerie Davidson to be the successor to the lieutenant governor. So the reason Alaska doesn't have long lines of succession is because the governor gets to make those appointments. And so from what I could see in Article 3, Section 9, it says, in case of temporary absence of the governor from office, the lieutenant governor shall serve as the acting governor. It doesn't say anything about swearing in. And what's interesting about the temporary absence is other states are specific in what they say constitutes the governor's being incapacitated. But in Alaska, it's even broader where it's a temporary absence. So if the governor was on a plane and couldn't be found, and I actually think some of this came from a particular instance of where there was a missing plane and so on and so forth. But so Alaska, you don't even have to say why. They're just temporarily absent. The lieutenant governor shall serve as the acting governor. So there is no time between swearing in that there's nobody in charge. And so that, I thought the line of authority and having civilian authority for the National Guard, to me, it's such a fundamental piece of American government. And I think that that's the intent of our Constitution, our state Constitution.
Noted. Representative Ledoux. Further questions, or I realize also we might be getting into comments too. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Dole, so I'm trying to understand it truly, and this is way out of, it's an issue I never deal with, so I'm completely unfamiliar with the military makeup. So as I, correct me if I get this wrong, organized militia are volunteers. They are not enrolled service members. They are not National Guard. They are private citizens. Is that correct? Organized, I'm talking the organized militia, not naval militia, not National Guard.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, the organized militia, the Alaska Organized Militia, does in fact consist of the Alaska Army National Guard, the Alaska Air National Guard, the Alaska State Defense Force, and the Alaska Naval Militia, as those who have taken a deliberate action to take an oath to serve the state.
I misspoke. It wasn't the organized militia I was referencing. It was the State Defense Force. Is that how I read that right? Did I say that right? State, what's the one I'm looking for? State Defense Force?
The Chair, Representative Knopp, the Alaska State Defense Force is part of the Alaska Organized Militia.
But they are not active military members, not part of a branch of the military. The State Defense Force are in fact volunteers. Do I have that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Knopp, all members of the National Guard have both a state and a federal military affiliation. The Alaska State Defense Force only has a state military affiliation, but they are part of a militia or state military force. They are recognized by the U.S. Constitution and 32 United States Code Section 109 as such.
Okay, just follow up. So I think it's probably Section 1 that bothers me the most, and you're probably intimately familiar with this bill. And in the very first line, it says control and command of the organized militia. And then we're deleting Alaska National Guard and Alaska Naval Militia, which, whether it's the intent or what, but it's what it says. And so really, we're taking away all control from the governor. It's all going to Adjutant General, with the exception of the State Defense Force. Is how it appears to read. And as you continue reading on the page two, it continues to say the same thing. The governor has no control. The adjutant general does pretty much his wishes, but he doesn't. It's really taken all authority away except for the State Defense Force as I read this bill.
To the chair, Representative Knopp, our interpretation is the governor retains all control of the Alaska Organized Militia, which includes the Army Guard, the Air Guard, the Naval Militia, and the Alaska State Defense Force. The change is, but to make all-inclusive language, we have said the Organized Militia, substituting that for the prior Alaska National Guard and Alaska Naval Militia, in terms of cleaning up some of the different places the Alaska State Defense Force was mentioned in Title 26.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So let's go back to your example of the child that's lost. So how many people right now does the Adjutant General have under her command without calling up anybody?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, right now we have about 4,000 individuals, 4,100 in the Alaska Organized Militia, i.e. not involving a call-up of the Alaska Unorganized Militia.
So right now, even if this bill weren't passed, she could call up 4,000 people just on her own?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, first, under this bill, in order for her to call up anyone, there has to be a request from a civilian authority to do so. She cannot say that kid is lost. I'm going to send 4,000 soldiers to go look for them. More than that, she cannot on her own. She remains fully accountable and answerable to the governor of the state of Alaska as the commander-in-chief. To the extent he has delegated to her the authority to do something, she could. However, we don't have that now. If he directed her, I take that back. Today, if there's a wildland fire that required 4,100 guard, ASDF, and Alaska Naval Militia members, she has the authority to call them up to fight a wildland fire.
Without calling the governor?
Under the delegated, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, sorry about that, under the current statute, which gives, has delegated to the Adjutant General the authority for wildland fires, she can call up the force for that situation. Now, she remains answerable for the governor as to why she did it, as well as the Alaskan people, but she does have that authority.
Just follow up.
Okay,
for wildland fires, she can do this without calling up the governor. Lost child.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, she can't call up a single person.
Pardon me? She cannot call up a single person. She has to call the governor.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is correct. She only has delegated delegated authority under the existing statutory construct for, can we say forest fires? It's easier than saying wildland fast. Forest fires or wildland fires. Any other situation where there's life at peril, that still requires a governor's call first.
Now.
Follow-up?
Follow-up. Okay. So, right now, she gets information about a lost child. I guess somebody calls the National Guard. So, she then calls the governor, right?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is incorrect. She only calls the governor when she is requested by competent civil authority. The Alaska State Troopers probably in a rural area for search and rescue. If there's a municipality, it would be the mayor. If the mayor said, hey, we need the assistance of a unique capability to do this, then she could. On her own, we don't self-deploy.
So I'd be kind of curious to know what the procedure is when she calls the governor because the civil authority has asked her to call to do something. And she calls the governor for the okay, and the governor is gone. Does she get patched through directly to the lieutenant governor? I mean, the executive office must have some sort of, when the governor's gone, we patch people through to.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe typically the first attempt is a direct call between the adjutant general and the governor, typically. After that, the adjutant general can reach out to the executive staff to make that connection happen. If it doesn't, and then they can attempt to patch through to the lieutenant governor's staff, assuming he's in a place with cell coverage to attempt that call, and he's at a place where he's taking messages, not in the midst of a meeting. But there's a process involved. There's that invaluable time element we're losing while we're losing sunlight, and that child is out there needing aid.
Follow-up?
So I guess my question is, and maybe you're not the one to answer the question, maybe it's somebody in the governor's office, it would seem as if when the governor is on a plane or under surgery or just, you know, gone, that there must be some sort of procedure in the governor's office to simply patch somebody. This is somebody, like the adjutant general says, this is an emergency, I need to speak to the governor right away, and the governor's office knows that the governor is, you know, incommunicado, to patch that person directly to the lieutenant governor or somebody in the line of authority. Is there not anything? I would kind of think that there might be something like that.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, given enough time, the adjutant general can always reach the lieutenant governor if the governor is not involved. The challenge there is, going back to our hypothetical where time is of the essence, for whatever reason the governor is unavailable, he's on a plane. The adjutant general doesn't know that. The executive office transfers to the lieutenant governor's office to track the lieutenant governor down, who isn't looking at his phone in a meeting with constituents. So somebody has to track him down and get his attention to look at it. That's still a time factor, and that time factor adds up in an emergency. I mean, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in a municipality, typically we want our law enforcement officers to respond in 3 to 5 minutes is an ideal for many municipal areas. We can't, we're spending that long just in the phone tree here.
I get that. But my question is, doesn't the executive branch or the governor's office actually have some sort of procedure? Somebody calls the governor, somebody like the adjutant general calls the office, and this is an emergency, I need to speak to the governor. If the governor's going to be out of town or incommunicado or what have you, isn't there, without the adjutant general saying, okay, well, I'm going to hang up the phone and now call, try to reach out to the lieutenant governor, isn't there just some sort of way that the phone gets transferred over to the appropriate person? It would just sort of seem that way.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, even for a transfer of that type, calling the governor's office to then contact the lieutenant governor's office to perhaps have an electronic buzzer or something on the lieutenant governor's arm to let him know he has to break off that meeting and come out and address something, there is still a time factor involved. It isn't an instant communication where the governor or the lieutenant governor is instantly available. And is the concern to reduce that time to provide a more meaningful and effective response that this bill addresses?
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Well, the governor does have a guide, right? As a protocol, emergency protocol. I mean, I, as mayor, had to deal with things disaster-wise. I had my staff do some research on other states and kind of some random sampling, and I guess I want to like to go back to how many states have this, because I just couldn't find any. I mean, there's lines of secession that go very deep. It looks like California goes all the way down to the chair of Board of Equalization. And there's a lot of lines of secession, and there's other states like that, but Alaska doesn't have it quite so much. But couldn't the governor designate the adjutant general because of the way our powers are set up? He could do that without having to have it codified.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, Lieutenant Colonel Weaver looked at this issue and found that other states have the ability to make such a designation of the adjutant general. I retain responsibility, but I give you the authority in these limited situations to do something important. The difference is we could not find another state with the language that specifically delegates only for wildland fires, such as our statute does. It is that statutory limit that appears to limit overall where the governor can delegate from a statutory construction basis, i.e. how our statute is constructed. We appear to have limited his ability to delegate only for wildland fires. That is leading to this discussion today. And that's the difference between our states and the other states. No one else specifically says the governor can delegate for wildland fires. And by specifically mentioning that sort of emergency but not others is what brings us here today. Every other state that we have looked at has a means of one sort or another to delegate, and they're not limited because of a constricting language like that.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Maybe we just randomly sampled five states. The first five states that we called, including talking to the Attorney General, said that they have the delegation like that. And then the states that we didn't look into already have at least an eight. Well, like I said, we didn't call California because they have a line of authority that goes so deep. I guess I have concerns. I don't know when we get the comment part, but I guess I'd like to know what statute. I mean, I know we have this piece in the statute here. You're talking about them taking out you're saying it, the wildland fires that's noted here indicates it's to exclusion.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we have Lieutenant Colonel Weaver on the phone who has this before him, as well as the original statute. I'd ask that he specify the exact, through the chair, that he specify the exact statutory limiting provision we're looking at and which section it's in.
And if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We just went over the Budget Subcommittee for Military and Veterans Affairs, and the Disaster Relief Fund actually spells out a lot of disasters that that is beyond the wildfires. Incidents such as storm, high water, wind-driven water, tidal wave, tsunami, earthquake, volcanic eruption, landslide, mudslide, avalanche, snowstorm, prolonged extreme cold, drought, fire, flood, epidemic, explosion, or not. And that's not including any type of, those are natural disasters. That's the reason why we opened that up, is because we can spell it all out, but natural disasters just seem more appropriate.
Further comment?
For the Chair, Representative Johnson, and having a moment to look at the statute, if you look at Section 2, the provision to be proposed at the bottom to be removed from Alaska Statute 26.05.070, the language that is in all capitals at the end. In the event of wildland fire, the governor may delegate to the adjutant general the governor's authority under this section to order some or all of the organized militia into active state service to fight wildland fire. That is the limiting factor. That language in 260570 appears to exclude the adjutant general's authority or the governor's authority to delegate to the adjutant general under this section the ability to call out the organized militia when needed for an emergency such as this.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Dole, I'll tell you what sounds odd to me. It sounds like you're saying that the adjutant general only has one single line item of delegated authority, and that just seems like the oddest statement, natural fires or wildland fires or natural disasters, but it's one single line of delegated authority. And I just can't imagine, even though it may not be in this particular statute, under an executive order, administrative order somewhere, that there's not more authority delegated. It just seems odd. You know, you talk about the chain of events. In this day and age, I can't believe we'd be that far behind the governor's been all over the world in his last 3 years here. What are we doing every time he's off? You know, I mean, last week, as you mentioned, just back from D.C., so it just doesn't make sense. It absolutely makes no sense what you're telling us. And that goes to Representative Ledoux's question. You know, what are you doing if? What are you doing if? And I think that's what she was getting to. One single line delegated authority. There's got to be more to it than that.
Through the Chair, Representative Knopp, if there were, we wouldn't be sitting here today. The 64-year-old statute is what brings us to this precipice today when we have had this situation arise before the lawyers and Department of Law, as well as the Alaska National Guard has identified the specificity of this section is overall limiting the authority of the governor to delegate to the adjutant general the ability to utilize the Alaska organized militia for other situations. Emergency situations as requested by local civilian authorities.
I maybe want to confirm my understanding along the lines with Representative Knopp, also in hopes that it might clear things up for myself, maybe for others too. So every single time in the last 64 years there's been the hypothetical lost child, and the local search and rescue or competent civil authorities have said, we need help, we need special capability, this is beyond what we can do. There has been a call from that competent local civil authority to the adjutant general saying, we need help, and the adjutant general in every single instance has in turn called the governor to ask for basically the governor's green light to deploy Alaska militia assets to assist that search and rescue effort, and that has happened for the past six or so decades.
Through the Chair, competent civil authority has made a request for assistance. Some have contacted the adjutant general, some have called the governor directly, as frankly mayors are prone to do, chief executive to chief executive. Other times the mayor or his staff has contacted the State Emergency Operations Center that is also part of DMVA to contact the adjutant general. But there's been an input from a local civil authority requesting military assistance that has then translated into either the governor telling the adjutant general to see what can be done if it went into the governor's office, or DMVA requesting of the governor's office authority to assist if they determined they had the capability and ability to do so.
So the answer effectively to my question is yes.
Is effectively yes. I did not want to limit it, though, to everyone calls the Adjutant General, sure, which was the concern with your question, as stated, Mr. Chair.
Sometimes they call the governor directly, but one way or another, there's a call going up to some high-ranking person somewhere in the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
I have one last follow-up before I get to Representative Ledoux. How often does this happen, say, per year?
Mr. Chair, we would need to follow up on that to give you an exact frequency of how often this happens. I can't give you those numbers as I sit here.
Could you ballpark it or speak to an order of magnitude?
Mr. Chair, I would hesitate to. I believe more than once a year. I'm comfortable saying. Can I say? Is it five? Is it ten? I suspect it's less than 10 times a year, Mr. Chair, for those minor incidents. However, I don't monitor those day in, day out. The Adjutant General is commanding the Alaska Organized Militia while I'm down here meeting with y'all. I don't know what she's doing, for instance, as we sit here.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
During that time, the past 60 years, how often has the Adjutant General not been able to get into contact with the governor immediately, and how long was the time frame before she could get he or she could get into contact with some sort of executive authority that could make the call?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, under our statute and these authorities being placed in the governor, there is no delegated authority to others to serve as the commander-in-chief but for the governor, which is what we believe brings us here. I cannot tell you the number of times in the past. I would note, however, that the National Guard and the has gained far more capability to assist. The Alaska State Defense Force did not exist in 1955, nor did the Alaska Naval Militia. There wasn't as much reason to call the National Guard for an immediate response as opposed to a slow, deliberate process that would allow for assistance in the past, because they didn't have the capability, if we look back in, say, the early 1950s, to instantly respond like they do today. But I cannot give you, through that historical time frame, we don't have the information on what that process has been like for response times.
So,
follow up?
So I remember a long time ago, back in Ohio, there was something at a university. I think the name was Kent State. So I think in that case, the governor called in the National Guard. Under this bill, if the governor couldn't be reached automatically, the Adjutant General would be able to send troops onto, for example, a university campus without any civilian authority giving the go-ahead?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, no. Because of the concern about actions against other Alaskans rather than saving Alaskans, this bill specifically excludes from the ability of the Adjutant General to utilize parts of the Alaska Organized Militia, to use them in a law enforcement or a maintain law and order or responding to a civil disobedience situation. The belief is, because of the significant role when you're going to impact Alaskans' rights, not save Alaskans, but impact their actual individual rights, only the commander-in-chief should make that call. So if he's unavailable, the college police are on their own with whatever happens on the college till he's available under this statute.
But just
follow up.
Just a follow-up. But I guess you would say that if you're looking for, let's say, you think a child's been kidnapped, and you find, and you're looking for the child, well, then necessarily you'd be looking for the bad guys too. So I'm not sure that it is a really firm distinction between looking out for Alaskans and a law enforcement aspect, if you're kind of following me.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think the case law of the Posse Comitatus law spelled out on the federal side after the Civil War, where federal military forces were used to maintain law and order in the Confederate states, is an example of where there's an ample body of law that kind of parses those out in those situations. My interpretation as I sit here is really you're calling in the organized militia, including the National Guard or the ASDF, for a law enforcement purpose if they're involved in trying to track down kidnappers, even with a child involved. At that point, the go-ahead authority would have to wait for the governor. Granted, it would leave the child at risk. We acknowledge that. However, in looking at the overall balance of the desire to save Alaskans, but also save Alaskans' rights, that's where we would, pending my being overruled by the Department of Law and the staff judge advocate, I believe that one would come out where the guard would not be deployed for an active search involving kidnappers. That's a law enforcement activity.
So in summary, lost child, the authority exists. Lost child kidnapped by bad guys, authority does not exist.
Mr. Chair, under the new statute, that was correct for the adjutant general. As it sits today, we're standing by to reach the governor.
Okay, more questions. Representative Johnson, I think you're next.
Well, I guess I'm a little bit confused because I'm thinking if we have a lost child and a missing governor, I mean, that's kind of what we're looking at. But we have the troopers. They're not like we don't have a emergency services out there. We've got different types of, you know, groups that are already in place to do to look for the lost child. I mean, when I think of calling out the National Guard, we're talking about a disaster declaration or something that's happened in that particular sense. But to me, it's like I don't know what problem we're trying to fix here, because we already have a line of succession. We have a line of succession that it's very clear. I have the catastrophic event booklet that the governor protocol that the governor is to follow when he calls out the guard. And just because this law is old doesn't mean it's not constitutionally correct. And it's a working, I mean, it's been working. We as far as I can tell, this is not the problem we have with National Guard. I'm actually surprised. I thought we were going to be looking at more civilian control, that the goal was more civilian control. That's always been the idea between having a National Guard and having the governor in charge is a civilian control. And we have a line of succession. We don't have these missing times that the governor, if the governor's not there, the Constitution provides for another civilian to be in charge of it. So it gives me a lot of pause to think of putting the military in charge of something without the governor being in charge of it. So, I mean, we have a line of succession, and I guess I'm just trying to hit that home a little bit.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, when the military responds, the civilian authorities, the incident commander remains in charge. The chief of police, the Alaska State Trooper, detachment commander, whomever. Also, civilian authority retains responsibility, but also ultimate authority over the actions of the military who are there, and has at any time the authority to call them back or limit what they're doing. I fully agree with you. There are fantastic search and rescue groups out there. There's one group from the Valley that they have their run at Eklutna Lake every year. Maybe we can meet at that this fall. But when you get into situations that exceed the capabilities of the equipment they have, where you need night vision goggles that we can use courtesy of the federal government, where we can use other equipment that is not available to these hardworking nonprofit groups, but we can make available through the National Guard or the organized militia, that is where the civilian authority may request the assistance of those National Guard entities for admittedly a small-scale thing under the direction of that civilian incident commander to fill a gap in terms of taking care of that Alaskan in need.
And I'm going to ask that there questions, not comments, because we will get to comments. But if you have a question, Representative Johnson,
I can phrase all these as comments if you wish. I think that
as questions, you mean?
Huh?
As questions?
Yeah, I can phrase my comments as questions. I guess I do want to make note that I'm not talking about. I'm not trying to say in any way that the guard isn't appropriate or there isn't times that the guard is, you know, invaluable. But the incident commander can call the governor and get the guard in place. So here's a question. Have you ever, any children been lost because a guard couldn't be mobilized that you're aware of?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, not to which I'm aware. I'm aware of the guard being mobilized in other states and not always, and usually under the adjutant general's authority as opposed to contacting the governor first. I'm not aware of any situation in Alaska of that type. I guess our kids are more, have better woodcraft.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in previous discussions, as in yesterday, we talked about natural disasters, wildfires, et cetera, and then the lost child. Those are different kinds of incidents. Obviously, one's a natural disaster, earthquake, flood, tsunami, and one is, I understand, in a natural disaster, there may be some people that are lost, but if the event is solely a lost child, does it fall under the wildland fire, earthquake, flooding? Is it still applicable? In other words, for an individual case, or is it just something where the troopers will, you know, or local authorities if there's a lost child, and then, you know, and I guess also the question of the lieutenant governor being the next in line, as was stated, I believe, according to the Constitution, but that there's still some ambiguity about that. So two questions.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, Deputy Commissioner Dole again for the record. If we look at the proposed amended language in Section 3, which is on page 3, and if you look at that Section B starting with line 3, where we talk about under imminently serious conditions where time or circumstance does not permit approval from the governor, we believe that would encompass these smaller disasters than a tsunami or an earthquake. That also is very important to at least one other Alaskan out there, the one at risk.
Further question, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the event of wildland fire, earthquake, flooding, or other natural catastrophe, or under imminently serious conditions. So the imminently serious conditions could be a lost child.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, Deputy Commissioner Dole, again, if we look farther down there in that same section, where it says to save lives, prevent human suffering, or mitigate great property damage in the state. To save human lives, we believe, or prevent human suffering would encompass this situation.
Okay.
And if I may,
Representative Tuck?
Thank you. I just want to point out that immediate response, imminently serious conditions, and that can also be oil or hazardous substances being released that may create dangers to, again, human lives. It could be enemy or terrorist attack, and it can be outbreak of a disease as well, trying to contain that. So I think it's appropriate that if in emergency situations that if the governor isn't available, that we need to take quick action. I think that's what the big question here is whether or not we are allowing the adjutant general to act to save lives and prevent human suffering, that or do we want to go through the succession process and potentially put people in danger, or depending on the, we just had an earthquake recently. If the governor is somehow incapacitated, or the acting governor is somehow incapacitated, because it would naturally fall down to lieutenant governor, do we want to wait to get, you know, how far do we want to go down before being able to take action in these very limited situations? And Section 1 is very clear. Section 1 talks about the role that the Adjutant General has. It shall carry out the policies of the Governor in militia affairs. The Adjutant General represents the Governor and shall act in conformity with the Governor's instructions at all times. And it's also subject to review. And it's also on that page 3, looking down on page on E, it has to be continually trying to get a hold of the Governor, and it has to look at it within 72 hours and whether or not the operations. I'm saying no, but that's, I'm reading to you right where it says. That's what the bill does. And so I think we're getting a little bit sidetracked on some of the lost child scenarios, but we're looking at other catastrophes as well that the militia may be able to get called in.
All right. Representative Knopp, you're next. Thank you.
My last question, Mr. Dole. Thank you. Can you explain to me a little bit, our active military members at Jay Bear and Eielson and others know they're subject to be called out in the case of emergencies, we'll call it, natural disasters, whatever. Is that done federally or at the request of the state? I mean, same process. I guess I'm asking you to explain to me a little bit about that, because we see them frequently up the mountain picking people off the mountain. Maybe it's a training exercise. I'm not sure. So I'm just wondering, is that a resource that can be utilized, and what's the process for deploying that resource?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, in the case, I think we may have blended two situations there in your discussion. In any event, there's a former Air Base Wing commander in the form of Brian Duffy back to my left rear who has, as a base commander, can talk about an installation commander perspective. The overall concept, though, is it's called defense support to civilian authority. When requested by civilian authority, the federal military commander can authorize the use of his military forces to assist those civilian authorities for up to 72 hours under immediate response authority. Now, the actual scenario, was that a helicopter with a hoist and a refueling probe out of the front of it pulling those individuals off the mountain? That's actually the Alaska Air National Guard federalized to do those missions as part of the active Air Force under a standing memorandum of agreement under the, basically, active Air Force is responsible for aviation search and rescue in the state of Alaska. And they do that by having an agreement with the Air National Guard. We train, but when called upon, our individuals can be federalized just for that mission or another delegated mission from federal authority. But they are doing those missions under federal authority, which gives them the authority when requested by competent civilian authority, which for the mountain case is either the National Park Service 9 out of 10 times if it's a federal land, or it is the Alaska State Troopers if it's other than federal lands.
Representative Ledoux.
All right. I may be reading this wrong, but I want to go to Section 2 on page 2. So, and I'm looking at lines 12 and 13. And it's looking to me like the National Guard does have authority with respect to law enforcement, because it's talking about, like, if a mob or body of men act together by force or intent to commit a felony, etc. So that kind of does look like law enforcement, or I'm just reading, is this some sort of legislative drafting thing that I'm reading wrong?
Through the May I respond, Mr. Chair?
Representative Tuck.
I'm sitting over there, but the question is, this is the governor's authority, Section 2 is. So, yes, the governor will have the authority to be able to act under this. This isn't the Adjutant General authority. This is the governor's authority to go ahead and institute the organized militia under these conditions.
On line 9, I think.
Lines 12 and 13, actually the whole section. Section 2.
Well, again, then I'm looking at section at line 19 there, and it's talking about the portion of the militia ordered into active state service by the governor, it becomes an additional police force. So, again, this is just, I'm not sure what question I'm asking, but I'm confused, so maybe somebody can help me here.
Well, if I may ask a question to clarify in the comments by Representative Ledoux, what the scenario Representative Ledoux is describing, that does not change under this bill. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Mr. Chair, and also trying to answer Representative Ledoux's question at the same time, Section 2 is the authorities that currently exist for the governor to basically do what is the federal equivalent of martial law. The governor retains those authorities that he has now. Section 3 is what specifically deals with adjutant general duties, which are authorities. So can the National Guard be used for law enforcement, stopping riots, insurrections? Yes, at the direction of the governor. He can send them onto that college campus we talked about earlier. However, the difference is the adjutant general, even under this bill, may not do so because her authorities are in Section 3, not Section 2, which takes the existing language and just removes the wildland fire specific delegation that is in large part brought us here today.
If I may confirm, the Kent State scenario that Representative Ledoux has mentioned, that can happen right now before HB 152. It could happen after HB 152. We hope it never happens, of course, but for purposes of illustration, this piece of legislation does not affect that scenario one way or another. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Only the governor can send a guard to deal with that.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Section 3, page 3 at the top, to the extent it's natural disaster, wildland fire, earthquake, flooding, tsunami, etc., it makes perfect sense. You know, the governor's not available, there's flooding, there's a landslide, there's some sort of disaster, we got to get on this right away. I'm still not quite sure why Lieutenant Governor doesn't automatically take over, but and then imminently serious conditions, and then save lives, prevent human suffering, or mitigate great property damage still falls under the natural disaster. But Representative Tuck did mention a terrorist attack. And to me, that's not a natural disaster. So if there's a terrorist attack, the governor's on a plane to China, the adjutant general can sort of send in the guards. I guess that part of it concerns me to the extent of, I don't know what that response would be. It's not about, you know, stopping the flooding or getting people out of rivers, et cetera. I don't know what that response would be. But if a terrorist attack falls under imminently serious conditions, I don't know if that's, I don't know. And I guess I'd like a legal opinion on that. So if we start going into terrorist attack stuff and the adjutant general can do something for 72 hours, and even though they can try, but not later than 72 hours after the order. So technically, she could go for 72 hours in charge, and I guess that when it starts going to terrorist attacks, then we're not in natural disaster area anymore.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, Deputy Commissioner Dole, on behalf of the department, we believe in constructing this, adding this section to the part of 2605-070 that would stay in place. The National Guard could be called in for a terrorist attack for what we call the consequence management. That is, if a building had been reduced to rubble, the National Guard could be called in to assist with extracting them with it. However, the limitation specifically contained where the governor can only make those calls dealing with more the dealing with bad people part of the prior section would limit their ability to go actually engage the terrorists directly. However, to help Alaskans with the consequences of that terrorist act, we believe this would give us the authority for going into that rubble pile or going into the other aftermath of a terrorist attack to assist Alaskans.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about, say, not dealing with bad people, but let's say shutting down the airport? And the decision of the adjutant general might be, you know what, I don't know what's going on right now. I'm going to shut down the port. I'm going to shut down the airport. I'm going to put a perimeter around it. I'm not going to look for bad people. I'm just going to put the place on lockdown. I mean, that's not really a aggressive military action. It's more of a defensive action, I guess. But would that be something that would fall under his or her authority?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, Deputy Commissioner Dole, on behalf of the DMVA, we do not believe so. We believe, again, the reason you put security people there is to interact with the population to direct a certain activity or conduct. It is when we are when the military is called in to direct an activity or conduct, we believe we fall into what is solely within the authority of the governor and not delegable under this legislation.
May I summarize? So, building collapses, you're just trying to save people, the adjutant general has the authority to deploy militia. Building collapses, but there's still terrorists at large, no authority. And if there's a perimeter set up in the scenario that Representative Wohl just described, the adjutant general does not have authority, only the governor has authority. Do I have all three of those scenarios correct?
Through the chair, with the caveats that one civilian authority calls to civilian authority could set up the perimeter in which the National Guard or the Alaska State Defense Force carried out that rescue activity, which would be a way that's frequently done other places to limit the law enforcement role to the civilian authority while the military provides other unique abilities to assist.
Noted. Representative Ledoux.
Okay. Page 3, section 3.
Wow. Okay.
It seems pretty broad. But then it's limited by section 3, paren C, where it says that regulatory, that it can't, the adjutant general can't use military power that is regulatory, prescriptive, proscriptive, or compulsory. So I guess you view that section as why it couldn't call out the National Guard to Kent State, right?
Through the chair,
or UAA.
Representative Ledoux, that is correct. That or that security perimeter described by Representative Wohl. That's specifically spelled out who can do it in the first section. This section says the adjutant general can't.
Okay. So if that's correct, then let's go to F. Why do we need F? Where it says the organized militia may not be used against or to mitigate a lawful activity, including an organized labor activity. Shouldn't we have in F, if we're going to have this bill, shouldn't we have in F something specifically that says that it can't use, the adjutant general can't do anything relating to policing? Because I'm not sure I'm reading regulatory, prescriptive, proscriptive, or compulsory. I'm not necessarily reading that as there can't be any law enforcement. I'm actually not sure how I'm reading regulatory, prescriptive, proscriptive, or compulsory. I mean, I'm not sure that it actually says that it can't do any law enforcement.
To the chair, Representative Ledoux, Deputy Commissioner Dole again. Subparagraph F limits both the governor and the adjutant general as to interfere using the Alaska organized militia to interfere with lawful activities. Why do we want the military interfering with lawful activities? I believe that language came about because of concerns in the past in other states and other places. The Alaska, or not the Alaska National Guard, but the National Guard of other states had been used in situations where citizens were engaged in lawful activity, and this is specifically barring the governor and the adjutant general from doing that.
Okay, just follow up?
Follow up.
Okay, so what exactly is regulatory, prescriptive, proscriptive, or compulsory? What exactly do we mean by that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, Deputy Commissioner Dole, I believe that language, again, goes back to what we talked about. Is a security perimeter or shutting an airport, is that law enforcement? It's an action where the military presence is being used to direct Alaskans to do something or not do something. That is to stop them from entering an area, entering an area, or other means directing a particular source of, have them act in a certain way or not act in a certain way.
So, just follow up?
Follow up.
So that couldn't be done? by the Adjutant General, period, without the governor's consent, right?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, Deputy Commissioner Dole, without the governor's authorization, not his consent, but his authorization.
Another follow-up?
You know, I'm just looking at all of these words, and I mean, I'm not sure exactly what it means by prescriptive or proscriptive. I'd kind of like an idea of what actions come under regulatory, what actions come under prescriptive, what actions come under proscriptive, and what actions come under compulsory.
If I may, I don't know if we have our lifeline still on the line to be able to answer that, because that's our legal attorney.
Sure. Lieutenant Colonel Weaver, can you hear us? And if so, can you speak to the, I guess, can you speak to the meaning or what categories of actions would fall under regulatory, prescriptive, proscriptive, and compulsory, respectively?
Mr. Chairman, this is Ron Clark, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Lieutenant Colonel Weaver had to step away. He's got several things going simultaneously here. I'll try and get back as soon as I can.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we would like the opportunity to provide a written supplemental answer to that rather than us providing what may not be a if we're talking about legal definitions, Mr. Chair, I believe we owe just something crisp and defined, not an off-the-cuff to those five terms of art.
And about those terms of art, are they terms of art that come from other sections of statute in Alaska or other states? Do you happen to know?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chair, I'm not sure totally on which ones are where. I've seen them in both places. I need to confirm how they're being used here.
Further questions, Representative Ledoux?
Not at this minute, but I'm sure I'll think of something.
I'm sure you will as well. Representative Johnson.
Well, I guess I'm just trying to get back to whether this is a constitutional bill. And with the lines of secession the way they are, they're clearly defined in our Constitution. So did you say that there was not an agreement on that? Or...
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, Deputy Commissioner Dole again. On that particular issue, a standing delegation is problematic. It's something we cannot directly address. It is not clearly defined under Alaska law if that can be done, just that standing delegation to always roll down the line, as opposed to just giving the explicit authority to delegate in this. We can deal with those military commander duties. Under our existing law, it is undefined.
So I had
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so I had an opportunity to have my staff speak with the Attorney General from another state that has their setup very similarly, and they didn't seem to have any kind of question about the structure at all, and it clearly said the governor can delegate the authority. If he so chooses, or the line of secession. I guess I just get back to the constitutionality of this and the intent of the national, of our federal constitution as well as our state constitution. And it still hasn't been made clear to me that this is a constitutional law to take it out from civilian control. And to me, civilian control is paramount in our government, and this just goes up against that. So I guess I wanted to hear something definitive on what you got on constitutionality.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, Deputy Commissioner Dole again, the definitive answer is it is not clearly defined under Alaska law. I'm not authorized to practice law in other states. However, under Alaska law, it is not defined, at my interpretation, as well as the Department of Law attorneys who have looked at this. And without that definition, there isn't clear-cut authority to proceed when necessary.
So follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So when it says Article 3, Section 9, Acting Governor, and the case of the temporary absence of the governor from office, the lieutenant governor shall serve as the acting governor. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, correct. That's what the language says. However, what temporary absence means and what duties acting governor takes, and it, can that be an ongoing whenever the governor steps out for anything, is an area that Department of Law maintains is undefined in this area.
So, follow-up, Mr.
Follow-up.
So I'm just looking at Article 3, Section 14. It says, title and authority, when the lieutenant governor succeeds the office of governor, he shall have the title, power, duties, and emoluments of the office. So I guess it looks like it's defined, but maybe I need to get a full opinion on that because I'm going back to the fact that it appears to me from everything that I've been able to dig up, that the governor has the executive authority over the National Guard, and it was intentionally set up that way. And
through the chair, Representative Johnson, Deputy Commissioner Dole, the governor does have and he retains in the proposed legislation. The difference between those two successions, those two provisions of assumes and succeeds, is again an undefined area. As you noticed in your own language, there are different words with different meanings. Succeeds is like a successor entity. It takes on and forever carries on the powers of that office. By comparison, the assumes with the temporary undefined nature is what makes that area problematic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So no matter what, though, is there any provision in the last Constitution, whereas a member of the armed services of the state, regardless of rank, is allowed to assume the authority of as commander-in-chief?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, to clarify, you said armed services in the state of Alaska. That would be a member of the Alaska Organized Militia versus a federal military person stationed in Alaska?
Oh, any member. Pick any military branch or
through the
portion of our section of our military.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, no.
Representative Birch.
I just had we had the zero, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had a zero fiscal note on this. I did note that in Section 12 that this revision allows the Adjutant General to authorize the extent funds are available payment of tuition for each active member of the Defense Force. And to the extent that this is extends tuition assistance program to basically anybody in the Defense Force and allows the Adjutant General authorized payment for the cost of tuition fees for education, vocation, technical training, how many people, through the chair, how many people are in the Defense Force that would qualify for this tuition benefit, and how much would that potentially cost? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I would start first by noting the amount that is allocated for tuition assistance for the Alaska National Guard is a set amount. If one National Guardsman or 4,000 apply, it cuts off at a certain amount, of which we have about 88% execution as of last year, I think about $300,000. This does not grow that pot. It just allows for different people to compete for or try to seek part of that allocation of funds, so there would be zero growth in funds in this case. The Alaska State Defense Force has about 120 active members at this point. Those normally this is these and the exact provisions that limit those that already have degrees. We'd have to look at the implementing regulations in effect at a time, but that would exempt some of those. But the outer ballpark of those that would is an additional 120 individuals could seek tuition assistance. However, the amount that could go to tuition assistance would not grow beyond the existing allocation. Just different folks could try to get it.
Okay, and then follow up. And what is there a cap, an annual cap on that, or is it X number in round numbers? Or
through the chair, Representative Birch. It's limited to the University of Alaska system, and there is a so we're not going to pay for someone to go outside. No.
Okay.
So, but beyond that, there is a limit on it's either number of credits or dollars, but it's a well-defined amount that we can provide additional information on how that works.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious if that was going to be kind of an unfunded obligation that we would be assuming at some point in time. So, great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
At this time, I would like to hold the bill, and I believe there's a few sort of standing requests for information, one looking at the sort of legal definition and specific actions that associated with each of the four words that Representative Ledoux highlighted, a few others, and perhaps also offer a few days or more than a few days for sponsors, often office and staff, as well as TMVA, to correspond with members of the committee. So at this time, I'm going to wrap up this meeting. We're next scheduled to meet Tuesday, January 30. And thanks to Martha and Max for keeping us going. And we are adjourned at 4:29 p.m.